This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What a treat to speak with Quentin Tarantino about his new book, Cinema Speculation. Film criticism, memoir, cultural history, a love letter to movies and the filmmakers who make them. It's all of these. I agree with The New Yorker's Richard Brody, who writes, there are three basic kinds of good nonfiction. The kind that results from consummately professional work, featuring thorough research, organizational clarity, analytical insight, wide-ranging knowledge, and writerly style. The kind that represents an outpouring of passionate affinity to the subject matter, a Virgil-like journey into otherwise inaccessible realms. And the kind that delivers the uniqueness of personal experience. Cinema speculation has a foot in all three domains. And my take is that Quentin pulls this off spectacularly. Like my last conversation with Quentin, we spoke by phone. I was in Coral Gables, Florida, while he was somewhere on the road in the middle of a very, very successful book tour.
You've written something that is so moving, and so it's kind of a love letter to writers, directors, movies. And actually, as I was reading it, and after I finished it, all I wanted to do was see those films that you wrote about that I knew nothing about, even though I lived through whole period.
So, well, thank you very much. Well, that's a really moving reaction to the piece. Thank you so much.
So the very first movie I remember seeing at the age of six was Psycho. And it kind of scared the shit out of me. And I'm wondering, what were my parents thinking? And then I read, and I didn't become a great filmmaker like you. So somehow, something got lost for me. But when you started seeing these films at a very young age, your world was very different. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, look, I have a line in the book that I've read a couple times and when I do live readings, and it always gets a good response, and it kind of made me realize that it was a better line than I thought. But also, the more I've been reading it, the more I've been kind of doubling down on the sentiment of it. So I'm talking about, how do some of the other kids respond to, me seeing these movies in like third grade or fourth grade that they weren't allowed to see. And I go, and I say, and well, you know, I came across as pretty sophisticated. And then I say, and because I was seeing the greatest collection of movies that America has ever made during the time that they made it, they were right. I was.
No, absolutely.
I feel incredibly lucky that my entire experience of what going to the movies was like was going to see the best movies ever made.
It's very fortuitous that you started seeing movies as early as you did. And I think that's what I loved about the structure of it. I mean, I started writing, I have lists and lists of the movies that you mentioned. Starting in the very first chapter of Little Q Watching Big Movies, right? All those, I guess I was, you know, like a 15-year-old, 16-year-old trying to be hip and cool. And I didn't find myself in a lot of Jim Brown movies, you know, in those days. But I realized how much I missed. It's the same thing when, you know, when I had friends at the time who were listening to Bootsy Collins and Farm and Funkadelic. And, you know, I was listening to, like, Bob Dylan and all those guys. And now, as an adult, I'm realizing, man, I missed a lot of great stuff and have come to love that stuff now. But I want to go back and I want to watch all those Jim Brown movies, particularly the one that you talked about.
Some of them are pretty fun. Now, the one I would recommend is not the one I talk about, Black Guy. All right, the one I would recommend is, I think, done the same year, the movie Slaughter.
Slaughter is the one you recommend? Cool.
Yeah, cool. Slaughter is really fun. Slaughter is really good.
Yeah, but actually what you did when you wrote about it is you wrote about it through your eyes. And tell me about the choices you made in writing this. What were you thinking when you decided to sit down to write this? Because it's part memoir, it's part film criticism, it's part celebration. What was your strategy?
Well, it's interesting. It's a good question. I think with any other literary endeavor, maybe what I started off with isn't necessarily what I ended up with, you know, and I had to go on the journey, not exactly knowing where the journey would end. So if I were going to, if you're talking to me 2 years ago, when I was beginning to write this, I would have probably said, oh, well, it's just going to be a collection of analysis, different chapters dedicated to different movies that I decide to write about and I decide to put under the microscope or I have something to comment on. And it would just be a collection of those movies. And if I had even made like a table of contents of the movies that I would have talked about back then, just to inspire myself, there would probably be quite a few movies that would be on that list, on that imaginary table of contents that didn't get talked about in this film, in this book. And so that was the idea, just to be this collection. Then I ended up writing what I thought was going to be like an introduction, which is ends up being the first chapter, Little Q Writing Big Movies. Now, that writing like that wasn't necessarily what I was trying to do. I wanted to indulge in more analysis. But when I wrote that chapter, I realized, okay, this is the book. Everything happens here has to have an umbilical cord that's connected to that chapter, and I need an end at the very end.
The way you bookended it with the Floyd Ray Wilson footnote, footnote.
Yeah. So after I wrote that chapter, all of a sudden, it put limits and structure and demands on the book that it didn't have before, which was a very a potpourri of whatever movies I wanted to write about. After I wrote that chapter, then it was like, okay, I really can't write about any movies that I did not see in during that time when it was released. Not that I even have to talk about having seen it at that time, but it all has to be connected to that little cute chapter. These were things that I discovered then. Now I can feel differently about them now, but it's like they all have to be from that time period. It can be something I discovered later. And then that also connected that whether I talk about the personal experience of seeing it or not, I have to have a personal experience with it. That started turning the book into more of a memoir or autobiographical piece. But I'm actually really kind of happy about that as time went on because, Pauline Kael always said that they asked her, would she ever write her autobiography? And she goes, no, I already did. In all my reviews, it's there. And I think if you're writing if you're writing from a personal space when it comes to film criticism or film analysis, that you can't help but tell your story.
Well, you know, it's funny. When you wrote the Floyd Ray Wilson chapter, I thought, God, would I have loved to have been just a fly on the wall or a younger friend, a friend of of Quentin's and being able to listen to them talk and then go to the movies with them.
Yeah, no, I had a couple of friends that knew Floyd. They came down and we hung out at the apartment with me and them and Floyd. Yeah, Floyd was a cool cat. Everybody that met him really fucking dug him.
Yeah, but, you know, even, you know, so I remember the 70s really clearly. And your deep dive and knowledge of that period is so overwhelming. And what you did, which I so appreciated, because I believe in this with books as well, is that in many ways, writers of today are standing on the shoulders of others, and they don't even realize it, right? And what you did is you drilled down. You took a film like Bullet or some of the other stuff, and you drilled down as to where it came from, as to who their influences were, and why it worked.
What I didn't expect to happen in the book, that just sort of happened by happenstance, is I didn't expect it to have moments of actual film history reporting in there. And that ended up happening in some of the pieces. One, because I just, you know, I know a lot of Hollywood lore. I know a verbal history of how this came about and that came about. And that was, and writing that in my own words, you know, became a fun little history lesson. But then, you know, I didn't know what I was going to get when I called up Walter Hill to ask him about, you know, some of the experiences of making The Getaway. Well, he ended up having this, of course he had this incredible amount of knowledge. It was a big, important part of his life, and he was involved at every step of the way. So he gave me such a magnificent verbal history of exactly what was going down during the making of that movie, that it became one of my favorite pieces. And I was like, okay, I don't want to do every piece like this, but this is a really interesting way to go about some of it.
It was a great way of doing it. And I also liked all the Paul Schrader stuff with
I loved all Taxi all
Driver.
All Paul's quotes in it, some of the best stuff in the book.
It's not only amazing, but it, you know, not having that deep, broad knowledge as you do, I didn't realize all that stuff about all of his screenplays, which none of them really got made the way he wanted them to be, right? They were all, in essence, kind of rewritten one way or another. And what happened with Taxi Driver?
At least they're thematic, sort of, yeah, their thematic directive or ambition was thwarted.
Well, we could probably talk all day about a lot of this stuff, but I'm going to throw out some things that struck me and that I just jotted down as I was reading it, and tell me what, you know, just riff off of it and tell me what you think. So we talk about, and it's going to be very like all over the place. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, one of the greatest movies of all time.
Okay. You literally, for your first one, you're probably writing the one piece in the book that I feel I did a cop-out on.
Well, the reason why I brought that up first, you know why I brought that up first? My wife now, the very first date we went on, I said, well, let's go to a movie. And I said, where do you want to go? And she said, let's go see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It should have given me some insight into what the next...
That sounds like a keeper.
She is a keeper. Tell me why you think it's a cop-out, what you wrote about.
Not that statement that I think it's a great film, is the fact that I don't deal with it, all right? You know, the fact that I, you know, say, well, this is a perfect film, and what's there to say about a perfect film? So let's move on.
Because
such a fucking cop-out. Just because it got hard, because it's hard to describe why you think something is perfect, I just move off from it. It's like this total fucking cop-out.
Well, I took it because you were writing about another film in that chapter.
I was. No, that's true. That's true. But it's not like I don't spend four pages on other movies.
You do. All right. So I won't make you figure it out now. The other thing that was really interesting to me was the influence among all of these different directors of The Searchers, right?
Yes. No, that is very... No, that is
talk
really
about
interesting.
That.
I always... and this is not even a comment on the searchers of, like, does it deserve this recognition? Does it not deserve this recognition? That's not even important. But the fact that, like, a big quartet of the movie brats, Scorsese, well, you have much of them, more than a quartet, Scorsese, Schrader, Spielberg, Mulius, and even Bogdanovich, the fact that they revere the searchers to such a degree, that's always kind of been curious to me. What was it that they responded to the searchers so much about? I mean, I think the answer is the characterization of Ethan Edwards. But nevertheless, it's still a little bizarre that they would revere the searchers seemingly above most other films of that era. Makes me feel I'm getting old. That's the way I feel, but I guess
it's funny,
the way it is.
I was just in New York and I went to see which one was it? It was the one by the Ian Asharin one came out. And I went into the movie theater. The ticket cost almost $20 to go sit in the movie theater. It was kind of astonishing, and it was in one of those old Lincoln, the Lincoln. And it was a big, beautiful theater, a big screen, and it wasn't very crowded, but there was still something better seeing it there. But I'm like you, I miss it. I miss not going, I miss not having it be the event-based film that everyone was talking about and arguing.
Yeah, but I mean, my feeling about that, though, went deep into my 30s, to the, coinciding with me making movies, because, I did this at 14 or 15, but I was doing it at 25 or 26, where I would get the, I would get in the morning the calendar section of the Los Angeles Times, and say six movies were opening up that week, and I wanted to see four of them. And then I might wipe them out all. I might wipe out all four on that Friday. I would lay out the newspaper and say, okay, where are they playing? Okay, so it's usually a choice between, do you want to see it in Westwood? Do you want to see it in Hollywood? And I never just chose what was convenient, because if I wanted to see this one playing at the Village in Westwood and I wanted to see this one playing at the Egyptian in Hollywood, then I would go back and forth depending on the showtime. So I would just sort of like map out my whole day. I'm like, okay, I can go see the 10:30 show of this, and then if I haul ass, I can get over to here, almost like I'm at a film festival. I can get over to here and see this. Then I'll have a little bit of time for lunch, and I'll grab lunch, and then I'll go to Westwood at the Bruin to see blah, 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 blah.
I don't know.
Then
that's
I can see the midnight. Then I'll have a little bit of time off, and I'll chill out. Then I can see the midnight show at the Crest, blah, blah, blah.
That still seems like a lot of fun. Something that, no matter how old we get.
Describing it sounds like a lot of fun, yeah.
It might just be something that we need to
do. I got to think of a time where there's going to be four movies I'd want to see on a given day that are just have to be opening up that Friday.
That is the problem, isn't it? So, I mean, you also talk about, and I want you to discuss this a little bit, and I remember it clearly. I mean, I remember when old Hollywood gave way to new Hollywood, right? When the Young Turks were taking over in 69, 70.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you felt like, wow, they're speaking to me in a way that they weren't before, in that mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah.
Being 15 to 18 to 20. So that really, I remember that happening. And you write about it so eloquently. And you write about so specifically as well about the different directors, and you even parsed the different kinds of, there were the auteur directors who came more from the European sensibility, and then there were the ones
like the anti-establishment guys versus the movie guys.
Yeah, right. Talk about the anti-establishment auteurs that who would those be?
Okay. The fact that I was able to even come up with that title, the post-60s anti-establishment auteurs.
I love it.
And then even have somebody but you vaguely quoted, all right, oh, wow, that's actually, I've done something. Because no, Michael Pyle, like, defined that other group as the movie brats. But right. I thought the post-60s anti-establishment on tour is, like, really, you know, that really did describe Altman. That described Bob Rafelson. That described Jerry Schatzberg. But absolutely. It is interesting because I think oftentimes you do just link all the 70s directors together. And I thought it was an interesting thought experiment to write out about the fact that, no, these two groups had completely different agendas and kind of came from a different place as far as what they were trying to do with, as far as their ambitions of film were concerned, and just even their ideas on film.
Yeah, I you know, I loved your chapter on Daisy Miller. And I love that you brought, you know, you focused attention on Barry Brown's story. That was very, very touching and moving. And that you included
that was the piece that I was the most moved about after I wrote it. Because it just kind of happened, that ending. Yeah, and I was expecting to throw it to Barry Brown at the end, but I didn't quite expect it to expect it to be so poignant. And so it kind of got to me. It was like I meant everything I said, but then I almost really meant it after I wrote it, if you know what I mean.
Right, exactly. For those who don't know, explain Barry Brown's significance.
Yeah, Barry Brown is was a young actor in the late 60s, kind of an Andrew Prine, you know, a male ingenue type, kind of a soft leading man that, you know, appeared in a lot of television shows around that time. So he's like in the Mod Squad, and he'll show up in Bonanza or some other show like that. And then at some point he got lucky and was cast in the lead in Robert Benton's first film as a director, Bad Company, with him and Jeff Bridges. A really terrific movie, by the way. And then so now he's a leading man, and he followed it up as the leading man in Peter Bogdanovich's version of Henry Miller's Henry James Daisy Miller. And he's so perfectly era appropriate for the film.
Right.
It's like he stepped out of a classic painting, all right, in order to play the role.
Right.
And then, you know, what happens to him afterwards is maybe, you know, the film is a flop, and then that kind of signals the end of his leading man career. He has a couple more independent films, but for the most part he kind of drifts back to doing guest shots on TV shows like he had done before. So now he's on Ironside, and now he's on Police Woman, and he's on these shows. And then his last movie in 78 is Joe Dante's Piranha, which he's actually quite funny in. And then he killed himself.
And
I ended up writing that piece. But then I even found out about the idea I did not know until I did some research, and found out that he was a cinema expert on genre cinema and on horror films in particular, and like really cutting edge stuff, actually, not just what I wrote. Like really great Z stuff. He could talk about that. And he used to write for Castle of Frankenstein magazine, which was the Fangoria of its time.
And you included the article you wrote on Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, I looked it up. I looked up a friend of mine has a collection of all the Castle of Frankenstein. So then I read the Bela Lugosi piece. I'm like, oh my God, this is really good. This is really neat. And this is just in the late 60s. This is just before the 70s starts and his action career takes off. And so I just found it was like I think after that last line, there's a poignancy about Barry Brown that was just sort of hanging in the air. Yeah. And I thought something more needed to be said, but not necessarily by me. And I thought by including one of his articles, by a really good article by him at the end, that would let that moment finish in a more Barry Brown centric appreciation kind of way.
Yeah. So for those who haven't read it, I mean, I think that's what you do in this book which it's not just straight film history. It's an emotional ride as well because of choices like that you've made. And then there's Brian De Palma, right? You spent a lot of time with Brian De Palma, and I never knew that his fascination with Hitchcock. I should have probably, but I never really knew it. But you talk about something that I had not that aware of, and it's just me, I guess. But the whole notion of cinema first, camera first.
Yeah.
What is that all referring to? Cinema first, camera first.
That just means, you know, the cinema of pure cinema. So it's not the cinema of great literature, and then these actors are sitting there reciting text, and the point of the camera is to capture them reciting text and saying lines and talking to each other and telling this story. The idea is a cinema where the camera is the most important thing, and it is the motion picture camera and the art of cinema that's leading the story. It's more important than just the text that the actors are reciting. And, you know, that was Hitchcock's way, constantly.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the way of Hitchcock. That's the way of Joseph von Sternberg. That's the way of Max Ophüls.
And in fact,
that was what De Palma was, and that was what De Palma was interested in. He wasn't interested in cinema just to recite actors talking to each other.
Right, and you were very funny when you said you met his wife at one of the film festivals at Sundance, and you said that Brian probably wouldn't
like my movie. Well, why not? Well, because he doesn't like pictures of people talking to each other, and my movie is just pictures of people talking to each other. Hey, you're right, you do know him. He doesn't like that.
No, and then you talk about cinema speculation, which is the title of your book. You have you wonder what Taxi Driver would have been like if Brian De Palma had been the one to make it, and it would have been very different.
Pure speculation. It's just pure speculation. But I can kind of see the movie from his eyes if he did that. That makes a lot of sense.
You know, I know that you spent a lot.
It's a better movie. It's just an alternative movie.
Just a different movie. But I also know that you spent a lot of your early life, you know, you worked in, you know, video stores, and you were very involved with talking about cinema, being a champion for cinema. And a lot of this book is like that. It's like walking in and meeting the smartest guy you know about a particular art form.
The smartest guy you know about a particular art form.
You are. There's a course that could be. You could do a course around this book. I mean, you could spend a year, you know, taking apart the book and then basically watching the films, reading about it, all of that. You know, and I have to say, I actually have tried over the last month or so to watch a number of them, but they're not readily available, some of them. You know, they're not...
See, I don't have that problem with my video collection and my...
I know, my DVD and my film print collection.
I'm not a slave to your Amazon streaming service.
Well, I don't use Amazon because I'm a bookseller. You have this great podcast that I've listened to. And then you also have this amazing VHS collection, if I'm not mistaken, right? And that's pretty cool to think about. So, you know, first I looked up, I couldn't find Malibu High after you wrote about it. I thought, that sounds like a kick. I want to watch that.
Oh, it is a kick. That's definitely a movie worth watching.
All right, so where would I watch some of these if I can't find them? Is there any go-to streaming area?
If you hadn't unplugged your videotape machine a long time ago, I could lend you my Malibu High video cassette. If you hadn't unhooked your DVD player, I could lend you my. Maybe your DVD player is still hooked up. Then you could find on eBay a Malibu High DVD.
That's that's perfect. That's what I'll have to do. It was, you know, it's also...
don't forget to check on YouTube for some of this stuff, because some of this stuff is available for free on YouTube.
Oh, you know, that's a great idea, too. You know, I'm so glad you had an index as well. The index is really important, because you list, you know, all the films are in the index, which is great.
Like, the one thing I knew I was going to annoy the reader about is I don't have a table of contents where it goes through the whole list of the movies I go through. Especially since I had an imaginary one as I was writing the piece. But the reason I didn't include that is because, look, I'm the same way. If I buy a cinema book where it's some guy talking about this movie versus that movie, then I'm going to kind of read it all over the place and just read, you know, read the films that I care about the first, that I care about the most first, and then get around to all of them. But I didn't want to encourage that kind of reading because, look, it's... Whoever buys the book is their book. They can do whatever they want with it. But, you know, I live in the false hope that there's enough people that read it from beginning to end, because I think that's the best way to take the book, all right, where it will have its most impact. Because that's kind of how I wrote it, to some degree or another. And one of the things I think is interesting for a book that there's a lot of analysis base is, I think, characters emerge in the course of the writing of the piece, and they become characters. They literally become characters. Steve McQueen becomes a character, I think, over the course of time.
Completely.
So does Neil McQueen, frankly, to tell you the truth. But also, so does Burt Reynolds, and definitely so does Paul Schrader. So do I. And so if I'm talking about McQueen in The Getaway, I'm not reiterating anything I wrote in from Bullet, because I figure I've already established the character by that point in time.
This is a book that has to be read from beginning to end. It's really a book.
Oh, thanks for saying that. I don't think that will be how a lot of people will do it, but I can only hope that it is.
No, I think most people will do it, because it's really hearing your voice. I mean, your voice and getting to know you. I mean, we spoke maybe 6 months ago, and we talked about your previous book. But through this book, I really felt your presence. I know you have a bit of a cold, but would you mind reading a little bit of the book?
Do you want me to read some of those Floyd riches?
That would be very cool.
If I'm chronicling Floyd as a critic, because he had a lot of opinions about a lot of different movies, I compiled some of his remembered statements about films, and so I wrote it, as if they're critical quotes from Floyd. And I read some of these to a couple of friends of mine. They all ended up saying, "Okay, Floyd is one of my favorite film critics of all time." So these are some Floyd bits. And they will be read in the voice of Floyd. Floyd on the film The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Floyd on the film The Spook Who Sat by the Door. That movie was way too heavy for Hollywood, man. They had to shut that shit down. Floyd on the Mac. If Max Julian were white after the Mac, he'd be the biggest motherfucker in Hollywood. Floyd on Jim Brown. This is one of the best ones. People say Jim Brown can't act. I say I don't go to Jim Brown movies to see good acting. If I want to see good acting, I'll go watch Marlon Brando. I go to see Jim Brown movies to see Jim throw a motherfucker out a window.
That's good.
Floyd on Sidney Poitier. Sidney Poitier is a good actor, but he plays a nice guy, patch of blue roles too long. Now, I understand it. He had to play those roles so other motherfuckers could play other parts. But he done it too long. So when he's in Buck and the Preacher, you're like, so what? Now you're this guy? So when he's in Buck and the Preacher, you're like, so what? Now you're this dude now? Nah, man, you done played that other shit too long. I can't buy you in this Jim Brown shit. You ain't that guy. You're that motherfucker from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And is there another good one here? Where is it here? Let me find that Step and Fetch It part. Okay, cool. I found it here. Okay, so... Floyd was very pragmatic about the black performers for that time. They did what they had to do, is what he would say. I once put down Stephen Fetcher. He asked me, Have you ever seen Step and Fetch It? No, I answered. I didn't think so. Don't be so quick to make judgments about people stuck in situations you can never understand.
And he lived in your house for about a year and a half, right?
Or yeah.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. He was in the room upstairs, yeah.
And it's really, you know, you talk about how you kind of, you know, you knew he was there, but you knew you couldn't always count on him one way or another. But he was not necessarily a reliable adult.
He wasn't that kind of.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But you know, having said that though, it was funny because I gave my mom the manuscript to read, and the only thing she came back as far as like you know any kind of questioning my remembrance of things. The only thing she said, and was actually a nice thing for her to say, it made me actually feel good. You know, she was like, Quentin Floyd cared about you more than you make it sound.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. That's really cool, too.
Yeah, it actually made me feel good. It actually made me feel good to say that.
That is good.
And then I told that to some black friends. They go, of course he did! You can tell that in the fucking piece!
Quentin, it's been, you're amazing. I've loved the couple conversations we've had. How are you doing on this tour?
Me too. I was looking forward to having another one with you, and so close, too.
How's the tour coming? How's everything going?
Oh, we're having a ball. It's really, really a lot of fun.
I'm surprised
that we're selling out big theaters, you know. I was like, I don't know how well we'll sell out, but I'll do it. And then, like, usually by the time it's, like, it's the night, it's, like, 95% or completely sold out. And the audiences are really having a good time. I think they're really getting to know me in the Q&A. And when I do do a reading of a chapter, that really usually closes the night in a really good way.
No, I had no doubt that you would sell out, and I think no matter where you go, you would. So you still have that open invitation to come down here to Miami. Are you with your wife and son?
Yeah. Well, not right now. No, they're in Tel Aviv right now. So she's taking care of the fam in Tel Aviv, and then I'll join them again. I think you know at the. At the beginning of December, and I'll be there for the next couple months, you know, just for the holidays.
This book is brilliant, and I just want you to know how it affected me in a lot of great ways. And you have that.
That's very meaningful what you're saying, and I just want you to know I really appreciate it. I actually just woke up late today, all right? So I got up at 1-ish, all right? So I'm hanging up the phone now. I'm going to start my day. So you're starting my day in a really wonderful way. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, you have a real, you know, we care about you. We're going to be selling the hell out of this book. And thank you, Quentin, for being there for us. I appreciate it.
Oh. My pleasure. Thank you for being there for me. This has been a very moving conversation, and I really appreciate it.